Gary indicated that wouldn't be a problem, but he would need to disconnect the Coast Guard. Just before 3 p.m., we saw Bush stride into the underground bunker at Strategic Command, off at Air Force Base, Nebraska. Everyone stepped out of the West Wing Video Conferencing Center, except Frank Miller and me. The last item on the agenda was supposed to be where the president should be. Instead, we began there. "I'm coming back to the White House as soon as the plane is fueled," the president said. "No discussion." Item 2, briefing by Dick Clark. I walked through what happened from 0850 to 1006. 4 aircraft impacting the earth. Next, the response actions. The nationwide grounding of aircraft. The borders closed. The ports sealed. The forces on DEFCON 3. The government moving to caves. FEMA mortuary units en route to Manhattan. Next was issues for the next 24 to 48 hours. Given that the president had decided to return to the White House, I suggested that a constitutional successor be deployed with a support team outside the city. Commerce Secretary Don Evans was found and moved to a secret location outside the city. We would need another public statement by the president from the Oval Office after his return. Also to be decided was the continued grounding of the air transportation system. Military deployments to guard critical infrastructure here and abroad, and the schedule for reopening the markets. We needed to order the federal workforce to stay home. Basically, we needed the country to go on hold for a day or two, until we learned whether there were more attacks coming, until we organized improved security, until we began to pick up the pieces. CIA Director George Tenet was up next. He left no doubt that al-Qaeda had committed these atrocities. He had already been on the telephone to key counterparts around the world, lining up the forces for the counterstrike. Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld briefed on the status of forces. The Atlantic Fleet had departed Norfolk and was steaming with aircraft carriers and cruisers toward New York. He omitted the fact that no one had ordered the Atlantic commander to do that. At times like these, initiative was a good thing. About 120 fighters were finally circling America's metropolitan areas. Forces worldwide were on battle status. FEMA talked of urban search and rescue teams driving up the turnpike to Manhattan. A blood drive was underway. Emergencies were in effect in New York State, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Then the president was up, out, and in the air, escorted by F-15s and racing for Andrews Air Force Base. His was the only passenger aircraft in the air over America. The skies were clear. Somehow, FAA had landed over 4,000 aircraft, diverting flights from Europe to tiny Canadian fields with few, if any, hotels. Canadian citizens were opening their homes to strangers who were slowly piecing together what had happened to them, what had happened to America. After Bush left Omaha, World Trade Center Tower No. 7 collapsed, and with it, the mayor's command post and the Secret Service field office. In the Situation Room, the talk turned to next steps. "Okay," I began. "We all know this was al-Qaeda. FBI and CIA will develop the case and see if I'm right. We want the truth, but in the meantime, let's go with the assumption it's al-Qaeda. What next?" I asked the video conference. "Look," Rich Armitage responded, "we told the Taliban in no uncertain terms that if this happened, it's their ass. No difference between the Taliban and al-Qaeda now. They both go down." The Taliban was the radical Muslim group controlling Afghanistan. "And Pakistan?" I asked. "Tell them to get out of the way. We have to eliminate the sanctuary." Armitage was on a roll. If Pakistan did not cooperate, we would have a major problem with a nuclear-armed Islamic State. "We'll need presidential pressure on Yemen and Saudi Arabia, too," said John McLaughlin, Tenet's deputy. "And a major covert action program for 3 to 5 years. Support to the Northern Alliance." It was too late, however, for Massoud, the leader of the Afghan Northern Alliance. He had just been assassinated by al-Qaeda 24 hours before. There are 42 major Taliban bombing targets, General Myers said, reviewing a briefing handed to him. Just before 7 p.m., the 747 known as Air Force One touched down at Andrews Air Force Base, and the president moved quickly to Marine One, which was parked close by. The helicopter, accompanied by two decoys, took a circuitous path over the city before diving onto the south lawn of the White House. Above them, AWACS watched the skies, and vectored F-15s and F-16s on combat air patrol. They were also tracking a smaller Air Force aircraft with Secretary of State Colin Powell. Upon his landing at Andrews, a heavily armed convoy whisked him directly to the White House. At 8:30, the president addressed the nation from the Oval Office. Karen Hughes had built the consensus of the video conference into the message. "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them," Bush said. Immediately following the address, the president met with us in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, a place he had never seen before. Unlike in his three television appearances that day, Bush was now confident, determined, forceful. "I want you all to understand that we are at war, and we will stay at war until this is done," he said. "Nothing else matters. Everything is available for the pursuit of this war. Any barriers in your way, they're gone. Any money you need, you have it. This is our only agenda." The president asked me to focus on identifying what the next attack might be and preventing it. When, later in the discussion, Secretary Rumsfeld noted that international law allowed the use of force only to prevent future attacks and not for retribution, Bush nearly bit his head off. "No," the president yelled in the narrow conference room. "I don't care what international lawyers say. We are going to kick some ass." Bush had already learned that some of the hijackers were people that the CIA had known were Al-Qaeda and were in the United States. Now, he wanted to know when CIA had told the FBI and what the FBI had done about it. The answers were imprecise, but it became clear that the CIA had taken months to tell the FBI that the terrorists were in the country. When the FBI did learn, they failed to find them. Had the FBI put them on the television show America's Most Wanted or alerted the FAA about them, perhaps the entire cell could have been rounded up. Bush's look said he would want to come back to this issue later. For now, however, the president shifted to the economic damage. Somehow he had learned that four shopping malls in Omaha had closed after the attacks. "I want the economy back. Open for business, right away. Banks, stock market, everything. Tomorrow." Ken Dam, the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, filling in for the traveling Paul O'Neill, pointed out that there was physical damage to the Wall Street infrastructure. "As soon as we get the rescue operations done up there, shift everything to fixing that damage so we can reopen," Bush urged. Turning to Secretary of Transportation Norm Mineta, he pressed for the resumption of air travel. Mineta suggested that flights could begin at noon the next day. Brian Stafford urged the president to spend the night in the bunker, but he would have none of it. Following the meeting, he went to the Oval Office and began working the telephones. I returned to the Situation Room and found my team hard at it. Cressy was on the telephone to New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's chief of staff. "Anything he wants," Cressy said. "Troops, equipment, and if FEMA or any agency is slow, call us directly." Kurtz was talking to Verizon about the stock exchange. I asked him to put them on hold for a minute so I could give him what we in the White House called guidance. "From the president, for you. Two priorities. First, search and rescue. Second, reopen the markets. Let me know what you need to do that." Paul looked up, a bit of fatigue appearing for the first time. "How about 5 miles of fiber optic cable and a dozen switches and routers? Installed." "That shouldn't be a problem. We can get that," I pressed him. remembering the president's determination. So, can you have the markets open Thursday? I knew as soon as I said it was too ambitious. Even though we were already getting calls from CEOs at Cisco, AT&T, and others, offering personnel and equipment, no questions asked. Try Monday, Kurtz shot back, and went on with the call. Lisa was in dialogue with Governor Pataki.
Well, don't you have an estimate of the dead?
She asked. I took her aside. You know those chemical and biological detectors you're developing? I want some, now, here, and at the Capitol. Well, there are only three small problems with that, Dick, Lisa began. A, they're experimental. And B, they're in California. And C, nothing is flying right now. Right. So, here, at the White House, Wednesday, up and running, I asked. Okay, okay, she said, adding it to her list. The Navy staff of the White House mess had reappeared and were distributing sandwiches. I realized I hadn't eaten since the night before, when I had gone to a new seafood restaurant near the White House with Rich Bonin of 60 Minutes. Bonin was obsessed with Al-Qaeda, had done a story about terrorism with me and Leslie Stahl in October. They had taped 3 hours of interviews with me for a 17-minute segment. Now, without my knowing it, CBS was running much of the unused interview, including me explaining the concept of COG, continuity of government. The night before, Bonin asked if it was true that I had asked for a transfer. As of October 1st, I would be starting a new national program on cybersecurity. Bonin wanted to run the story that I was quitting the terrorism job in frustration with the new administration's lack of focus on Al-Qaeda. I asked him not to, but admitted that I had sought the transfer. It seemed like ages ago. I grabbed a sandwich from the mess and walked outside with Roger Cressy to the parking lot that had once been a public street, known as West Executive Avenue. My car was still parked askew in front of the West Wing. It was the only vehicle left. The night was clear and quiet. We were in the middle of Washington, and there was hardly a sound. I debriefed Roger on the principal's meeting with the president. I realized then that until today, I had not ever briefed the president on terrorism, only Cheney, Rice, and Powell. We had finally had our first principal's meeting on terrorism only a week earlier. The next step was to have been a briefing to walk the president through our proposed National Security Presidential Directive. The Washington Post later reported that this directive had, as its goal, to eliminate Al-Qaeda. The plan called for arming the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan to go on the offensive against the Taliban, pressing the CIA to use the lethal authorities it had been given to go after bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda leadership. Bush had never seen the plan, the pieces of which had first been briefed to Cheney, Rice, Powell, and others on his team in January 2001. I had not been allowed to brief the president on terrorism, in January or since, not until today, September 11th. It had taken since January to get the cabinet-level meeting that I had requested urgently within days of the inauguration, to approve an aggressive plan to go after Al-Qaeda. The meeting had finally happened exactly 1 week earlier, on September 4th. Now, as I was telling Cressy, I thought the aggressive plan would be implemented. Well, that's fucking great. Sounds like they're finally going to do everything we wanted. Where the hell were they for the last 8 months? Cressy asked. Debating the fine points of the ABM treaty, I answered, looking up at the sky for fighter cover. Yeah, they'll probably deploy the armed predator now, too, Cressy said, referring to his project to kill bin Laden with an unmanned aircraft. The CIA had been blocking the deployment, refusing to be involved in running an armed version of the unmanned aircraft to hunt and kill bin Laden. Roger Cressy was still fuming at their refusal. If they had deployed an armed predator when it was ready, we could have killed bin Laden before this happened. Yeah, well, this attack would have happened anyway, Rog. In fact, if we had killed bin Laden in June with the Predator, and this attack still happened, Our friends at CIA would have blamed us, said the attack on New York was retribution, talked again about the overly zealous White House counterterrorism guys. I tried to think ahead of what we could best do now. From here on in, it's a self-implementing policy, or as you guys from the Pentagon would say, a self-looking ice cream cone. But it's too late. Way too late. The best thing you and I can do now is figure out how to block any follow-on attack. We walked back in. The next task was securing the air transportation system so flights could resume. U.S. aviation had long been insecure, and the 1997 Commission on Aviation Safety and Security had avoided the tough decisions like federalizing airport security. The FBI had even attempted to eliminate the Federal Air Marshal Program in 1998, arguing that armed FAA agents on hijacked aircraft could be killed by FBI's commandos storming a hijacked aircraft. Now, we had thousands of aircraft scattered at airfields all over the United States and Canada, and probably 250,000 passengers sleeping on airport floors. We also had a continuing threat. Had all of the Al-Qaeda teams struck? We resumed our video conference, and I put the question to FAA. How could we resume flight? We can't just put everybody back on the planes and go back to business as usual, Mike Canavan was insistent. Canavan was an Army three-star general, a former commander of Delta Force, who had only recently retired and taken over the job of director of security at FAA. He had been in Puerto Rico doing a personnel shakeup of his San Juan operation when the attacks hit. Using his military contacts, he had grabbed a DOD aircraft to get back. Using his FAA contacts, he had been given F-16 escorts so that he would not be shot down by mistake.
We need to search all the aircraft and airports for hidden weapons. I think some of the knives or box cutters they used had already been put on the aircraft for them.
Canavan had a report of box cutters found hidden away on one of the aircraft that had been grounded. Mineta told the president that the system would reopen at noon Wednesday. That would give us about 12 hours, Mike. I was looking for a reality check from FAA, because my team did not see how the airports could reopen for days.
Open tomorrow? That ain't gonna happen, Dick.
Canavan had already had this conversation with his boss, following Mineta's return from the White House.
We have been on to the airlines.
They could not open at noon tomorrow even if they wanted to. And we don't.
I want federal air marshals on every flight.
Well, that means thousands of federal air marshals, and last time I checked, you had a few dozen, I said, knowing where Canavan was going. The FAA had flown armed agents on only a few flights on overseas routes. I made Canavan a proposal I knew he would like. After the bombing at the Atlanta Olympics, we threw hundreds of federal agents into security in Atlanta. Border Patrol, Customs, Secret Service, U.S. Marshals. We can do that again, but it will take days to brief them and position them. Canavan agreed.
That's what I need for now.
But we're going to have a dedicated, large federal air marshal program quickly. And it's going to cost. Mike, I told the president about the minimum wage rent-a-cops doing screening of passengers and carry-on. He understands that will have to end. We would have to screen every passenger closely before we resumed flights, and then we would have to put in place a permanent system.
FAA needs to take that over, too, Canavan pushed.
But for this week, we're going to have to supplement the rent-a-cops with the real thing, local police, National Guard, federal agents.
What about everything else? Paul Kurtz asked. Are we letting everything else resume flying this week? How do we check private planes?
I look out my window every day and see private jets taking off from National flying right at the White House before they veer off. Large passenger aircraft were only a piece of what had been grounded that day. Cargo aircraft, executive jets, personal aircraft, traffic helicopters, crop dusters, Goodyear blimps, and hot air balloons also filled America's skies on a normal day. Dealing with them would have to come later. I asked Kurtz to work with the FAA to phase those other aircraft back in, after we had a security plan for them. For weeks thereafter, I would catch snippets of Paul's conversations.
I don't care if there is no aerial camera shot of the game. no blimps over stadiums. And, what do you mean I still have all the traffic helicopters grounded?
Condi Rice joined us again in the Situation Room. The president now wanted to be sure that we were all going to get some sleep.
I need you bright and fresh in the morning. Go home, she said.
Rice made sure we understood. It was an order. I worried about her security if she planned to go back to her apartment in the nearby Watergate. So had the president. She was going to spend the night in the residence. After 1 a.m., I agreed to go home, briefly, to shower and change. Before I left, I called Pete McCauley to get a ride through the Secret Service positions around the building, and to put us on a list to get out and get back in. We drove through their barricades, down the empty streets. A Humvee, with a 50-caliber machine gun, was on the corner of 17th and Pennsylvania. We stopped on the Roosevelt Bridge over the Potomac and watched the smoke, still rising from the Pentagon, lit by the floodlights that had been brought in. It gave me a chill. As we pulled up to my house in Arlington and shut off the car, we heard the drone of a heavy, four-engine aircraft. AWACS was circling. An hour later, as I dressed to go back in, I wondered again how many Al-Qaeda sleeper cells were there in the United States. I had long believed they existed. So had John O'Neill, who was now dead under tons of steel. So Dale Watson, who had tried to get the FBI to look for the sleepers. Were there still cells planning more attacks? Thousands had died. We in the West Wing had almost been among them. Now, we had the full attention of the bureaucracies and the full support of the president. I had to get back to the White House and begin planning to prevent follow-on attacks. I found my Secret Service-issued .357 sidearm, thrust it in my belt, and went back out into the night, back to the West Wing. I expected to go back to a round of meetings examining what the next attacks could be, what our vulnerabilities were, what we could do about them in the short term. Instead, I walked into a series of discussions about Iraq. At first, I was incredulous that we were talking about something other than going after Al-Qaeda. Then I realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq. Since the beginning of the administration, indeed well before, they had been pressing for a war with Iraq. My friends in the Pentagon had been telling me that the word was out that we would be invading Iraq sometime in 2002. On the morning of the 12th, DOD's focus was already beginning to shift from Al-Qaeda. The CIA was explicit now that Al-Qaeda was guilty of the attacks, but Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld's deputy, was not persuaded. It was too sophisticated and complicated an operation, he said, for a terrorist group to have pulled it off by itself, without a state sponsor. Iraq must have been helping them. I had a flashback to Wolfowitz saying the very same thing in April, when the administration had finally held its first deputy secretary meeting on terrorism. When I had urged action on Al-Qaeda then, Wolfowitz had hearkened back to the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, saying Al-Qaeda could not have done that alone and must have had help from Iraq. The focus on Al-Qaeda was wrong, he had said in April. We must go after Iraqi-sponsored terrorism. He had rejected my assertion, and the CIA's, that there had been no Iraqi-sponsored terrorism against the United States since 1993. Now, this line of thinking was coming back. By the afternoon on Wednesday, Secretary Rumsfeld was already talking about broadening the objectives of our response and getting Iraq. Secretary Powell pushed back, urging a focus on Al-Qaeda. Relieved to have some support, I thanked Colin Powell and his deputy, Rich Armitage. I thought I was missing something here, I vented. Having been attacked by Al-Qaeda, for us now to go bombing Iraq in response, well, that would be like our invading Mexico after the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Powell shook his head. It's not over yet. Indeed, it was not. Later in the day, Secretary Rumsfeld complained that there were no decent targets for bombing in Afghanistan, and that we should consider bombing Iraq, which, he said, had better targets. At first I thought Rumsfeld was joking. But he was serious, and the president didn't reject out of hand the idea of attacking Iraq. Instead, he noted that what we needed to do with Iraq was to change the government, not just hit it with more cruise missiles, as Rumsfeld had implied. Joint Chiefs Chairman Hugh Shelton's reaction to the idea of changing the Iraqi government was guarded. He noted that could only be done with an invasion by a large force, one that would take months to assemble. On the 12th and 13th, the discussions wandered. What was our objective? Who was the enemy? Was our reaction to be a war on terrorism in general, or Al-Qaeda in specific? If it was all terrorism, would we fight? Did we have to attack anti-government forces in Colombia's jungles, too? Gradually, the obvious prevailed. We would go to war with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The compromise consensus, however, was that the struggle against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban would be the first stage in a broader war on terrorism. It was also clear that there would be a second stage. Most Americans had never heard of Al-Qaeda. Indeed, most senior officials in the administration did not know the term when we briefed them in January 2001. I found a moment without meetings and sat at my computer and began writing. Who did this? Why do they hate us? How will we respond? What can you as an American do to help? It all came out in a stream of pages. I wrote of Al-Qaeda's hatred of freedom, of its perversion of a beautiful religion, of the need to avoid religious or ethnic prejudice. Thinking it might be helpful, I sent it to John Gibson in speech writing. Meanwhile, Roger Cressy and I dusted off the draft National Security Presidential Directive on Al-Qaeda, authorizing aid to the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. Joined by Lisa Gordon Haggerty, we also began to list the major domestic vulnerabilities to further terrorist attacks, and to task the departments to start plugging the holes. Trains with hazmat, hazardous material, were diverted from major cities. Crop dusters were grounded until they could be tracked and we could be sure terrorists weren't filling them with biological agents. Special security teams were sent to protect telecommunications hubs, chemical plants, and nuclear reactors. George Tenet and Kofor Black, the counterterrorism chief at CIA, were off and running, demanding action from friendly intelligence services and preparing at last to send CIA officers into Afghanistan. Colin Powell and Rich Armitage were turning Pakistan around from half-hearted support of the U.S. campaign against Al-Qaeda to full cooperation. Later, on the evening of the 12th, I left the video conferencing center, and there, wandering alone around the Situation Room, was the president. He looked like he wanted something to do. He grabbed a few of us and closed the door to the conference room. "Look," he told us, "I know you have a lot to do and all, but I want you, as soon as you can, to go back over everything, everything. See if Saddam did this. See if he is linked in any way." I was once again taken aback, incredulous, and it showed. "But Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this." I know, but see if Saddam was involved. Just look, I want to know, any shred." "Absolutely," I said, "we will look, again." I was trying to be more respectful, more responsive. "But you know, we have looked several times for state sponsorship of Al-Qaeda and not found any real linkages to Iraq. Iran plays a little, as does Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia, Yemen. Look into Iraq, Saddam," the president said testily and left us. Lisa Gordon Haggerty stared after him with her mouth hanging open. Paul Kurtz walked in, passing the president on the way out. Seeing our expressions, he asked, "Geez, what just happened here?" "Wolfowitz got to him," Lisa said, shaking her head. "No," I said. "Look, he's the president.
He's not spent years on terrorism. He has every right to ask us to look again, and we will.
Paul was the most open-minded person on the staff, so I asked him to lead the special project to get the departments and agencies to once again look for a bin Laden link to Saddam Hussein. He chaired a meeting the next day to develop an official position on the relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. All agencies and departments agreed there was no cooperation between the two. A memorandum to that effect was sent up to the president, but there was never any indication that it reached him. The next week, President Bush addressed a joint session of Congress in the most eloquent speech of his career. Gone was any tentativeness or awkwardness as a speaker. Karen Hughes had drafted the text personally on her old typewriter. It included my questions and some of my answers. Who is the enemy? Why do they hate us? The weeks that followed were filled with meetings, back to back. A campaign coordination committee, co-chaired by Frank Miller and me, developed a game plan for attacking al-Qaeda. A domestic preparedness committee, chaired by Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, pooled the department's efforts to identify and remedy vulnerabilities in the U.S. to further attack. The cabinet and their deputies had had their eyes opened. It was a time of jitters. There were clearly bogus reports of commando teams targeting the White House and nuclear bombs on Wall Street. But many of the people now reading such intelligence had never seen it before and could not tell the wheat from the chaff. Reagan National Airport remained closed, but because of concerns about aircraft possibly headed toward the White House, we were on constant alert. Throughout it all, we thought of the dead, of the horror. Those of us who had stayed in the White House that day now knew why the United flight had crashed in Pennsylvania, that heroic passengers had fought and died, and probably saved our lives in the process. But we tried to stay unemotional, to stay focused on the work that had to be done, the work that kept us in the White House 18 hours a day and more, every day since 9/11. We were told that parts of my FBI friend, John O'Neill, had been found in the rubble in New York, and that there would be a memorial service in his hometown of Atlantic City. I told Condi Rice we would be taking a half day off. Lisa, Roger, and Bev Rountree joined me, and we drove to New Jersey. As the mass ended and John's coffin rolled by, the bagpipes played, and finally, I wept from my gut. There was so much to grieve about. How did all this happen? Why couldn't we stop it? How do we prevent it from happening again and rid the world of the horror? Someday, I would find the time to think through it all and answer those questions. Now is that time. Chapter 2. Stumbling into the Islamic world. Little noticed by most Americans, including in its government, a new international movement began growing during the last two decades. It does not just seek terror for its own sake. Its goal is the creation of a network of governments, imposing on their citizens a minority interpretation of Islam. Some in the movement call for the scope of their campaign to be global domination. The caliphate they seek to create would be a severe and repressive theocracy. They pursue its creation with gruesome violence and fear. To understand why that movement has chosen America as its target, and why America failed to see the effects of its own actions, we need to remind ourselves of some of the events of the last 25 years. The story, the strands of history that brought us to September 11th and to today's war on terrorism in Iraq, does not start with Bill Clinton or George W. Bush. It goes back to their two predecessors, Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. First, Ronald Reagan. He had been obsessed with aggressively confronting the Soviet Union, not just by outspending the Red Army. By confronting Moscow in Afghanistan, inserting U.S. military into the Persian Gulf, and by strengthening Israel as a base for a southern flank against the Soviets, Reagan changed the strategic equation. I had joined the State Department in 1979 to work on the issue of the Soviet Union's growing military power, particularly its nuclear weapons facing NATO. As 1979 came to an end, however, the White House froze all nuclear arms control talks with Moscow and began to concentrate on the Persian Gulf, the Middle East, and South Asia. The 1974 Arab oil boycott of the United States had made clear to Washington the importance of Persian Gulf resources. In 1979, Iran, America's greatest ally in the Gulf, was violently overthrown by a radical Islamic group. Then, on Christmas Day, the Soviet Red Army moved south in the direction of the Persian Gulf by invading and occupying Afghanistan. After the twin shocks of the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, our group of politico-military analysts at the State Department was given a new focus, the Persian Gulf. In the Persian Gulf, the Shah of Iran had served two useful purposes for Cold War America. First, he had guaranteed a source of oil unaffected by the Arab oil boycott. Second, he had offered to use Iran's newfound wealth to create a modern military as strong as Germany's on the Soviet Union's southern flank. Cold War America saw all foreign policy issues through the prism of the conflict between the two superpowers, much as we now see the world through the war on terrorism. The Cold War had parallels with the war on terror. Both conflicts raged globally, with regional wars, secret sleeper cells, and competing ideologies. The two struggles also threatened the horrific destruction of our cities by weapons of mass destruction. Our opponents in both vowed to sink the imposition of their form of government and their way of life on all nations. Following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, our analytical team began fielding questions from the State Department leadership and from the White House. A Soviet strategic bomber base appeared to be under construction in Afghanistan. From it, we were asked, could Soviet bombers attack U.S. naval forces in the Indian Ocean? Should the U.S. bomb the Afghan base before it became operational? We determined the construction was actually a Soviet agricultural aid development project. If the Soviet Union poured troops into Iran, could they get to the Persian Gulf before U.S. forces could stage a D-Day-like landing? Yes. Thus did the United States embark on a fevered campaign to develop the military capability to project force into the region and to create bases into which those forces could be sent. I was asked to meet with the U.S. military planners who were assigned to this task. Instead of finding them in the bowels of the Pentagon, I found them at the end of a noisy runway on a fighter base in Florida. They were in trailers, surrounded by barbed wire, and they were wearing field camouflage. Of course, I had to ask why. "We're called the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force," General Robert Kingston explained. "So I want it to look like we can deploy rapidly to the region." "Can you?" I asked. "No, but that's where you guys come in. You're going to get us some bases," Kingston smiled. Some of his military colleagues also thought it was a little odd that he was behind barbed wire and trailers in Tampa, and began referring to General Kingston as Barbed Wire Bob. His enthusiasm and sense of urgency were, however, infectious. My colleagues and I soon found ourselves negotiating for basing rights in Egypt, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. A year after the shocks of 1979, another unexpected event hit, dragging the United States a bit further into the politics of the region. A new president in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, launched a preemptive attack on Iran in an attempt to seize its oil fields. At first, Washington maintained neutrality. The United States did not have good relations with Iraq, which had been close to the Soviet Union. Our relations with Iran, however, were terrible and getting worse. The new Iranian government seized the U.S. embassy staff and held them for over a year. Iran then contributed to the turmoil in Lebanon, a nation that the United States had always considered a friendly and stable, pro-Western anchor at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. When the turmoil worsened in 1982, Ronald Reagan was in his second year as president. He ordered Marines into Beirut. Reagan explained to a prime-time audience that we went into Lebanon in part because of the oil. Lebanon had no oil. The Iranians supported Hezbollah faction in Lebanon, responded to the new American military presence by staging devastating car bomb attacks on the U.S. Marine barracks and twice on our embassy. In the attack on the Marine barracks alone, 278 Americans died. After the Marine barracks was leveled in Beirut, Americans were faced for the first time with what Middle Eastern terrorism could really do. After a series of bombings and shellings, Reagan ordered U.S. forces out of Lebanon. Throughout the Middle East, it was noted how easily the superpower could be driven off, how the U.S. was still shell-shocked from its defeat in Vietnam. Years later, Osama bin Laden would refer to the success of terrorism in driving the United States out of Beirut, a city whose pleasures he had enjoyed before becoming a devout Muslim. It was against this backdrop of hostile relations with Iran that the Reagan administration began to look anew at the war between Iran and Iraq. There has been speculation that the United States gave Saddam a green light to attack Iran, perhaps in the hopes that if he seized the oil-rich province of Khuzestan, we would continue to have access to Iranian crude, and perhaps because Washington hoped that the new Iranian regime would collapse without its major source of revenue. As far as I could tell, Saddam's attack on Iran was a surprise to Washington, just as his attack on Kuwait would be almost a decade later. Shortly after it began, the Iran-Iraq war became a stalemate, with very high casualties on both sides. Although not an ally of Iraq, the Reagan administration decided that Saddam Hussein should not be allowed to be defeated by a radical, Islamist, anti-American regime in Tehran. In 1983, a presidential envoy was sent to Baghdad as a sign of support for Saddam Hussein. A man who had been the Secretary of Defense 7 years earlier, in a previous Republican administration, was sent carrying a presidential letter. The man was Donald Rumsfeld. He went to Baghdad not to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but to save him from probable defeat by the Iranian onslaught. Shortly thereafter, I saw American intelligence begin to flow to Baghdad. When Iran was preparing an offensive in the sector, the Iraqis would know what U.S. satellites saw, and Saddam would counter with beefed-up defenses. In 1984, the United States resumed full diplomatic relations with Iraq. Although the U.S. never sold arms to Iraq, the Saudis and Egyptians did, including U.S. arms, some in violation of U.S. law. After the intelligence flow to Saddam was opened up, our State Department team was asked to implement the next option in the plan to prevent Iraqi defeat, identifying the foreign sources of Iranian military supplies and pressuring countries to halt their flow. We dubbed the diplomatic intelligence effort Operation Staunch. I spent long days tracing arms shipments to Iran and firing off instructions to American embassies around the world to threaten governments with sanctions if they did not crack down on the gray market arms shipments to Tehran. By 1986, the Iran-Iraq war expanded into attacks on oil tankers. We proposed that the Kuwaiti tankers be reflagged, their registration and names changed, so they became American ships, subject to the protection of the United States Navy. For the first time, we examined what to do if things escalated into a U.S.-Iranian war. Simultaneously, Ronald Reagan's administration was responding to the threat of the Soviet Union's military involvement in the Middle East by bringing the United States closer militarily to Israel. Our stronger military relationship with Israel was the right thing to do, militarily and morally. But the closer relationship with Tel Aviv did, over time, inflame some radicals and give them propaganda to help recruit terrorists to their anti-American cause. These actions by the Reagan administration were defensive. What the administration did in Afghanistan, however, was to go on the offensive in a way that drew the United States further into the region. In the mid-1980s, President Reagan and CIA Director Bill Casey hoped America could force the Kremlin to respond in ways that would overtax the Soviet economy. Afghanistan offered Reagan and Casey their best opportunity. Yet, despite the rhetoric, the Reagan administration had not significantly funded the Afghan resistance. By 1985, the analysts were growing concerned that the tide had shifted in favor of Moscow. My boss and mentor was a career ambassador, but hardly from central casting. Morton Abramowitz filled his darkened office with cigar smoke and left ashes in his wake. He had saved hundreds of thousands of Cambodians when, as U.S. ambassador to Thailand, he had initiated a cross-border feeding program. Later, as ambassador to Turkey, he would be responsible for starting a similar effort to save the Kurds in the wake of the first Gulf War.
"Don't just tell me we're losing, Clark. Tell me what the fuck to do about it."
That was how Abramowitz received our analysis of the shifting tide in Afghanistan. Our analysis had focused on the Hind D helicopter as the thing that had worked for the Soviets. Afghan bullets bounced off its armor plate, while the helicopter's rockets ripped apart the hidden Mujahideen camps. "We need to give them stingers to shoot down the Hinds," I shot back.
"Ah, come up with a new thought. CIA and the Pentagon won't agree to release those missiles."
Mort was relighting the stub of a cigar.
"You want to do something? Go see your friend Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness. Get him to release the stingers," he said.
Pearl was Assistant Secretary of Defense and greatly distrustful of the State Department, whom he saw as capitulationists and accommodationists in the Cold War. Now, at Abramowitz's urging, I had a private meeting with Pearl. I confronted him with the Pentagon's refusal to send stingers to Afghanistan. He at first denied it, but then hit an intercom button and asked an aide whether it was true.
"God damn it! Who blocked it? Well, fuck the CIA!"
He then hit another intercom button and more politely asked, "Can I stick my head in on Cap for a second?" Pearl left me alone in his office for a long time while he went down from the fourth floor to Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger's huge office on the Pentagon's third floor, E-ring. When he came back, his explanation was simple. Cap didn't know about it. I was still wondering whether his knowing about it now meant that he would approve the release of the Stingers to the Mujahideen. "No U.S. Army on the ground in Afghanistan," Pearl said. "The Muj will have to come out and be trained in Pakistan." The training was over and the weapons smuggled in by September 1986. Over 270 Soviet aircraft were shot down by the Mujahideen. The Soviets agreed in 1988 to pull back all the way out of the country, and did so the following year. Pakistani military intelligence, funded by the U.S. and Saudi governments, and charitable organizations, had turned groups of 19th-century Afghan tribesmen and several thousand Arab volunteers into a force that had crippled the mighty Red Army. The Stinger had been the final element that they needed. Were we right to have armed the Afghans with Stingers and other weapons? Was it a misjudgment to have involved the Saudis? There are many who believe that these were mistaken Cold War policies that laid the seeds of Al-Qaeda. Even with hindsight, I believe the Reagan administration was right to assist the Afghans and to drain the Soviet Union's resolve. The Stinger missiles were largely expended in the war or destroyed. Others were bought back. Some were not accounted for, but became inoperative when their unique batteries expired. None were ever used by terrorists, although Stinger became a generic name for shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles around the world. The involvement of the Saudis and other Arab states was also prudent. Not only did it reduce the financial cost to the United States, but it also proved to those governments that we had common goals and beliefs, despite our differences about Israel. The U.S. did, however, make four mistakes during the Reagan administration that affect us today. First, the fact that the CIA became dependent upon the Pakistani intelligence service to aid the Afghans meant that we developed fewer ties and loyalties among the Afghans. Second, when the U.S. engaged the Saudis, Egyptians, and other Arab states in the fighting against the Soviets, America sought, or acquiesced in, the importation into Afghanistan and Pakistan of an army of Arabs without considering who they were or what would happen to them after the Soviets left. The Saudis took the lead in assembling the group of volunteers. The Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki, relied upon a man from a wealthy construction family that was close to the Saudi royal family. Turki empowered a son of that family, one Osama bin Laden, to recruit, move, train, and indoctrinate the Arab volunteers in Afghanistan. Many of these volunteers later became the Al-Qaeda network of affiliated terrorist groups. Third, America's quick pullout of assets and resources following the Soviet defeat left us with little influence over or understanding of what happened next in Afghanistan. Pakistani intelligence used its power and influence to bring order out of the chaos through a new religious faction, the Taliban. The Pakistanis also facilitated the Taliban's use of the Arab-Afghan War veterans, Al-Qaeda, to fight for the Taliban. Fourth, the U.S. did little to help Pakistan understand or deal with the corrosive effects on its society caused by the mix of millions of Afghan refugees and the wealthy, fanatic, misfit Arabs who came and stayed. Instead, concerned with Pakistan's nuclear program, the U.S. cut aid to the country. The aid cutoff did not, of course, end the nuclear program. Rather, it ensured that the country that was deploying nuclear weapons was politically unstable and threatened with a takeover by fanatics. In the wake of their Afghan defeat, and, the Arabs believed, because of that defeat,